Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Tyson Center Faith for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace teleconference on Monday, October 8th, 2012, with our guest Andre Del Beck. And we're going to begin with a quick check-in. So please say your name and where you're calling from.
Peggy O'Neill, Fort Smith, Arkansas.
I'm Karen from from Maryland, not Michigan.
Catherine from France.
Ken DeRoche from Prince Edward Island in Canada.
Sarah Miller
Southern
from
California.
Lynette from
Plantville, Arkansas.
Joan Wiener from Philadelphia.
Sam Simon, I'm with Intersections, but I'm in McLean, Virginia today.
Joe Weiss, Boston, Massachusetts.
Pamela Longstreth, Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Thank you. Pamela Ramsfield from Fayetteville, Arkansas. I'm wondering if there's too much background noise from my phone.
In a minute, I'll turn off the background noise while Andre and I are talking.
Oh.
So.
Okay,
don't worry
great.
About that, but you can always hit star 6 if you want to mute
okay.
your phone.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking, Pamela.
Mm-hmm. Hello, it's Diane Williams from Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Hi, it's Deborah Talatrell from Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Yeah, well, I did.
Hi, it's Rhonda Ellis from Searcy, Arkansas.
Vivian Hill from the University of Arkansas.
All right, I think that might be everybody so far. Is there anyone else? Okay. So thank you for everybody for joining our call today. I'm going to put us in lecture mode, which hopefully will allow both Andre and I to speak, and we won't hear any background noise. And then when he and I are done, I will open it up for all of you to engage in dialogue together with Andre. So, Andre, let me check in. Are you able to speak? I don't hear Andre. All right, that's not going to work. Okay, so I've taken it off the lecture mode. And, Andre, what number are you calling in from?
Calling from 510-769-8730.
Isn't that weird? I don't see you on my screen. Okay, so what I'll do is just ask the rest of you if you can hit star 6 to mute yourself. That will allow Andre and I to be able to hear each other without the background noise. Great. And I see that Debu just joined us from Australia.
Good morning.
Good morning. We have good morning, good evening, good afternoon on this call. Welcome, Debu. And we, Debu, I'm going to ask that you hit star 6 to mute yourself while Andre and I are speaking, and then you can unmute when it's time to be involved in the discussion.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Star 6 will mute you. So we always begin with a quote, and this quote I've drawn, Andre, from the article that you wrote at my request for the Handbook for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace. So these are these are your words, and you wrote, "During the long years when the secular curtain was drawn within the Academy of Management, attention to values was not entirely absent. A secular and humanistic language utilizing such terms as individual worth, interpersonal support, stakeholder involvement, and so forth, often seeming a parallel to religious language, was present in some areas of management studies. But when the secular curtain was breached by attention to spirituality at the beginning of a new century, many of us felt a deep relief. Finally, one could draw upon the great religious and wisdom traditions, reference their symbolic languages, utilize their insights regarding spiritual disciplines that formed character and discuss a more comprehensive set of organizational outcomes beyond short-run utilitarian achievement. And so that is something that you were writing about in terms of the evolution that you've seen of the field. And we'll be talking more about that as we get into our discussion here. I want to introduce Andre to all of you. Andre Delbecq is the McCarthy University Professor at Santa Clara University, where he served as Dean of the Levy School of Business from 1979 to 1989. His research and scholarship have focused on executive decision-making processes, organizational design, managing innovation in rapid change environments, and leadership spirituality. He's the 8th Dean of Fellows of the Academy of Management, prior president of the Western Academy of Management, and former executive director of the Organizational Behavior Teaching Society. And these are all organizations that I've been a part of, and so Andre and I have been in many same circles together, and it's been quite a privilege for me to travel in these circles with him. Andre is recognized internally for executive programs delivered to high technology industries, as well as for health and human services and government organizations. He has served as the member of 3 corporate boards of directors and twice as board chair. Speaking of which, Andre, Joyce DeShano sends her love.
Oh, well, thank you.
I got to spend 3 wonderful days with her at the Dominican Sisters Conference, and of course we found out pretty quickly that we have you in common. That was a very, very precious thing. Andre directs the Institute for Spirituality of Organizational Leadership, conducting dialogue between theologians, executives, and management scholars. He is a member of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality and the Workplace Board of Advisors. And Andre is a keynote speaker at our Wisdom at Work conference. He will be talking about leadership development contrasted with leadership formation, distinctions, relationships, and potential synergies. And Andre will also be facilitating a workshop and also facilitating our dialogue and discovery session. So we're going to keep you very busy at the conference, Andre, and I'm so grateful for all that you're doing to be of service to this field and to the work that we both share. So welcome to this teleconference.
Well, thank you very much, Judy, and welcome to all my friends and new acquaintances who are on the telephone listening. I'm honored that so many would join me in this particular call.
And there's many more who couldn't be on the call, and the call's being recorded, and so it'll be available to others afterwards. So, Andre, you're very well known in your field for the work that you've done in executive decision-making and models such as nominal group technique, and you've had a change in your career direction, evolving into this interest in leadership spirituality. Can you say how that happened?
It really came about as a result of the executives I've been working with over the years. And as I have said on several occasions, it wasn't something that I ever anticipated. Late at night in hotel rooms and airport lounges after a hard day of working on strategic change, quietly they would begin to talk about the enormous difficulties and challenges associated with their roles, and then they would turn to me and say, do you ever deal with the inner life of a leader? And I would say, I'm not sure what you mean. Well, we have a course in ethics. We teach leadership. But what they were talking, of course, was spirituality. And it took me 10 years before I finally yielded to that persistent and consistent request to pay attention to that topic, and took a year and a half off to study in preparation for doing so. But it was really consumer pull in the sense that the request to address the topic came from the executives I was working with rather than an agenda that I had in my own mind.
Well, and yet you have had a strong spiritual thread throughout your life. When I told you that I was going to be spending time with the Dominican Sisters at their annual conference, you told me that you were very strongly influenced in your spiritual formation by the Adrian Dominicans. Can you say more about that in particular, and then more in general about your own spiritual journey, you know, that runs through this original management work that you were doing with executive decision making and now into this whole leadership spirituality work. What's the spiritual path part of that?
Well, I had the privilege of being raised in a devout Roman Catholic family, and I went to grade school and high school and Catholic schools. I worked, in fact, my entry into the study of business was a result of working with Catholic Charities and being frustrated by the fact that while their heart was in the right place, their understanding of organizations and leadership was very primitive, and I thought there must be some place one can learn how to be a more effective leader and construct a more effective organization. At the University of Toledo at that time, there was no public administration or social work administration, and so I went to the School of Business and found there exactly what I was looking for, an understanding of individual and group behavior and organization structure. But the inspiration was out of having looked at organizations addressing very important human problems. And so throughout my career, my interest has always been in organizations that are addressing a very important human need, and then how might they be more effective. My own spiritual development proceeded over the years in fits and starts and ups and downs. But I, like many people, led a departmentalized life in that I had to sort of never address frontally the way in which spiritual insights or my religious tradition or the insights of any religious tradition actually impacted on the subject matter. And I never expected to hear God, transcendence, spirit addressed in a business school classroom.
Or the Academy of Management.
Or the Academy of Management, to be sure. So,
my, how things have changed.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that as you began contemplating the questions these executives were asking you, that you took a sabbatical to go deeper into exploring these questions. And I know that you've met a lot of wonderful faith and spiritual leaders in your journey. Was it during that sabbatical, or was that like the start and has continued on? And maybe you could say a little bit about who some of these spiritual leaders are that you've met and how they've influenced you.
I had the privilege of spending a year and a half doing readings at the Graduate Theological Union under a very, very wise spiritual director named Frank Hudek, and with a Sulpician priest named James McGee. And because my students come from all traditions, Hindu, Baha'i, Jain, Buddhist, I felt that it was very important that I also study in the other traditions. And then I decided that I had the opportunity and the time to go and personally be with individuals who were seen as important religious figures in our present world history. And so I traveled to Ireland to meet His Holiness Dalai Lama, traveled to Colorado to meet Thomas Keating, who is a leader in Christian meditation, centering prayer and Christian mysticism. Went to see Zalman Schachter Shalom, who's a wonderful Hasidic rabbi. And in each instance, I would say, I am going to try to address the question of the integration of spiritual insight to the executives and business leaders that I teach. What words of counsel do you have for me? And they, no matter what, how well I thought I had begun to understand the topic, when you meet one of these wonderful individuals, your kaleidoscope clicks a few more notches and things change. And So that was really a very privileged part of my preparation to begin to teach in the subject area.
And then when say something about the teaching, is you have been widely recognized for doing something very innovative in terms of teaching contemplative practices and spirituality in the workplace. And probably many of the people on the call know about that work, but I'm sure that several people have not heard about what you're doing and might be inspired by it.
Well, in the wonderful way things unfold in the spiritual journey, the Association of Learned Societies and Contemplative Mind in Society had offered a fellowship to academics to integrate contemplative practice into subject matter. And so I was honored to receive one of those fellowships. There were faculty from law, architecture, business, religious studies, literature, etc. And off I went as a business professor to be with these individuals, and contemplative mind and society has deep roots in the Buddhist tradition, although they include other forms of meditation practice and welcome them. And I would not have had even conceived of including meditation practice as part of a course. And as I listened to, observed, and participated with these other faculty members, I began to think about how I might include both guided meditation and apathetic, non-thought, silent meditation into my course. And I did so rather hesitantly. And following each topic in the course, let's say one topic might be the mystery of suffering in the life of executive leadership, I would have students write a reflection based on the readings and the lecture and the class discussion on how they interpreted events in the 2 weeks since the seminar last met through that lens, what that lens had taught them, and then I would have a meditation assignment. And I was quite astounded that the interpretation through the lens of theory and the readings and concepts, although rich, was quite traditional and not particularly exciting. But the outcomes of their experiences through the lens of meditation was far more powerful. And 2 years after I had been teaching the course, Jim McGee, who had helped me think about the course and sat in the first time I taught it, came back to take the course, and he said, "Boy, your course has really changed." And I said, "Jim, in what way? You know, the topics are the same as when we offered it the first time." And he said, "Well, there's a great deal more attention to meditation as a discipline than when you started out." And I hadn't even realized the way in which that had expanded. But one of the intriguing knowledge bits that I would share in that regard was that I always asked my students, why are they taking the course? And in the beginning, the answer was Ian Mitroff's answer to try to eliminate the dualism between my spiritual self and my work self was the most predominant answer. Now, 98% of the students list as the reason they're taking the course understanding how meditation can allow them to live in the complexity of Silicon Valley more with greater inner peace and with greater effectiveness. And so meditation has really become an acknowledged and an important discipline that word of mouth among MBAs has indicated this is a critical reason why you might want to participate in the seminar.
Thank you for that. And also, you've structured it in a way that's kind of unusual in terms of who the participants are, in the blend of MBA students and Silicon Valley executives.
Almost every quarter, I have three or four executives from somewhere who attend the course. I've had executives fly in from Maine, from Milwaukee, from St. Louis, from Southern California, as well as local executives. And so the students are, you know, this is wonderful for the students because they have very mature and senior executives who in the classroom discussion talk about the importance and criticality of growth and spiritual maturity as part of being an effective leader.
Yeah, so they all learn so much from each other.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I haven't, the first time I taught the course, I personally set out to recruit 9 CEOs and 9 MBAs. Since then, the executives just show up.
What a gift.
I've been recruiting them. A telephone call or an email arrives saying, I've heard about your seminar. I wonder if it would be possible for me to sit in. So,
wow.
That continues to evolve.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I'm having a hard time hearing.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Andre, are you able to speak up? And is it my voice, too, that you're having a hard time hearing?
Your voice is strong.
Okay, so it's Andre.
All right, Andre will speak louder. Thank you.
You're getting too contemplative, Andre. Thank you. So one of the topics you'll be talking about at the conference is the contrast between leadership development and leadership formation. Can you give us a taste of what it is that you'd like to share with the people at the conference on that topic?
Well, we've had years of understanding what leadership development is. It's the development of concepts and skills, normally taught to a cohort group of executives, carefully contextualized to a particular corporate industry setting, with an opportunity for much of the learning to evolve out of the exchange between the executives, so with a very sophisticated adult learning methodology. What has now begun to emerge is a parallel experience for executives that address spirituality as the core subject, the concepts, disciplines, and practices associated with spirituality. And so I was interested in taking some of the topics in executive development and to see the way in which topics in courses and seminars and corporate programs and spiritual formation enrich the concepts that emerge in executive development. There is now, Catholic Healthcare, for example, has just published a public paper on the topics that should be included in a program in spiritual formation. And they're pretty much the topics that are included in most courses associated with spirituality. And so we're beginning to have a common set of concepts to address and a common set of skills to address. And so the question is, how does what occurs in spiritual formation enrich executive development?
So you'll be looking at comparing and contrasting, and it sounds to me like what you're talking about points to an evolution in what we do around leaders and their development and a more holistic formation model that is available to people, but they may not even know that this is being done.
Well, if you look at the Academy, if you did a meta-analysis of the papers that are published, the topics that are published, the concepts that are included in the concept of spirituality and instruments that define spirituality and its impact, if you look at the work on the spiritual maturity on the part of leaders, there are a set of pivotal topics that now are pretty much in common across both academic courses as well as programs for leadership development in organizations like faith-based healthcare. And so the question is then, what does, in what way does that set of programs, understanding that set of concepts and understanding the skill sets associated with formation, how does that enrich what's normally included in executive development programs? So I'm going to take three topics, the topic of teamwork, the topic of decision-making, and the topic of organizational culture, and I'm going to indicate how teamwork is addressed in executive development programs, and then I'm going to suggest how the topics that are found in spiritual formation enrich each of those three topics.
Oh, I can't wait to hear that. That's going to be very thought-provoking and inspiring, I'm sure. Every time I listen to you, it's just so expansive in terms of thinking about what's possible in organizations, and you always have wonderful examples about what's already going on that, you know, we just don't hear about in the management textbooks or in Harvard Business Review or in mainstream news or any of that. It's this well-kept secret about what's possible.
Well, so it's not as secretive as it once was. It's really, really wonderful to see the way in which these topics are more and more encountered in our literature.
For example,
decision-making, we know that more than 50% of the time strategic decision-making fails. It fails because of a regression to expert decision-making, assuming from past practices, the inability to listen to different stakeholder voices, the temptation to arrive at premature closure, et cetera. And those are all traps that are enhanced by hubris, narcissism, fear, anxiety, et cetera. So a spiritually mature executive should manifest greater humility, should be able to be more patient with the unfolding of discovery. I should be less driven to truncate the development of decision structures. And we know the types of spiritual disciplines that lead to that increased maturity. What's delightful is I went through this sort of creative laying down what are the essential principles around those three topics, and then how would spiritual formation enhance the ability of a leader to be effective? There are very clear and well-documented testimony that spiritual understanding and spiritual disciplines enhance the ability of leadership effectiveness.
Well, if that's true, then
it would seem that those organizations that are spending time on the formation, spiritual formation of their leaders, those universities that include attention to the spiritual development of students will have emergent leaders who behave in a different way and draw on a different set of strengths that are complementary to important aspects of managerial behavior.
It'll be a better world. One of the things that I asked you to do for this conference came out of our Board of Advisors meeting, because you serve on the Tyson Center board, and we were talking about how the Tyson Center could have a greater impact by bringing together faith leaders and business leaders and academics and students to, you use the word discovery, to be in discovery together. And you talked to us about a format that you use called Dialogue and Discovery, which is going to happen on the second day of our conference. You'll be facilitating a Dialogue and Discovery session for us. Can you describe that a little bit for people who, I know many of the people on this call are actually going to be at the conference, and some can't, but they might be inspired by knowing that such a process exists.
you know, one of the dreams that all of us have when we're young academics is that being part of a university will allow us to sit down with a knowledgeable set of colleagues and we can address a particular problem. Let's say a problem might be in the connection with spirituality. What's the influence of humility on leadership effectiveness? And, you know, we will be able to sit down with colleagues and think about creative ways to both explore the concept, share information about contemporary literature that applies to that topic, think about creative designs, and in particular help individuals use designs that are compatible with their own personal preference, whether they're the use of sociometric instruments or whether it's qualitative research, whether it's surveys, et cetera. Well, the problem with the new field is that most of us at best have one or two colleagues in our immediate department who are exploring this topic because it's a young, emergent area of scholarship. And so the notion is, could we have a conversation, the kind of conversation that you would have with a set of trusted colleagues in which you could propose an arena of interest that you would like to explore, and through conversation, enrich creative ways of addressing the topic, equalize sharing of information, and develop creative research designs to move the field forward. And so that's the concept that I talked about when we met, and that's the session that you're planning for your forthcoming conference.
And we also talked about not just academic research, but applied research or business research that can serve an organization or serve a church or religious organization, so that there's something for all the stakeholders and a way to have multiple perspectives on particular issues and challenges that we face. So I'm really looking forward to that. I expect there's going to be a lot of creative energy and hopefully some real concrete collaborations that come out of that. But that idea came from you, and I'm just so excited that this year you're able to be with us and help facilitate that session. It's, I hope it'll be really meaningful for everyone.
Well, thank you. I look forward to it. And I think, in fact, emergent fields, that is, topics that aren't terribly mature, are the places where possibilities of collaboration between working professionals, consultants, trainers, and academics is the richest, because much of the work is early and formative, and therefore the exchange between the professional perspective and the academic perspective is particularly important. So we are in an arena that in which that kind of partnership between the professional manager, the consultant, and the academic would be particularly fruitful.
We're going to have an exciting group of people there to be in dialogue with. There are business leaders and from small and large organizations. There are a number of workplace chaplains representing different religious traditions, as well as a Tibetan Buddhist monk and somebody from New Zealand and Norway and India and Australia. And so it's going to be very, very exciting to have all these people with somewhat different perspectives coming in to explore and hopefully discover new ways of looking at things. And yet there's something that binds us together in terms of our interest in this, how the wisdom traditions and the faith and spiritual traditions can help organizations and leaders to be more effective. So it's only a few weeks away, and I'm getting real excited.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to the conversation and the company.
Fellow travelers on the journey. Speaking of fellow travelers, let's open up the lines now for anybody on the call who would like to make a comment to Andre or ask a question. And so just, again, say your name and where you're from so that Andre can sort of place you, or maybe he knows you, and then go ahead and ask your question or make your comment. And if you're muted, star 6 should unmute you. I'm going to also try to unmute everybody.
Now, is that unmuted now? This is Joe Weiss.
Yes, Joe. We can hear you. Hi,
thank
Joe.
Thank you. Andre and I are friends and go back, and I do know his work, but I thought it might be interesting if, Andre, you could give us a little hint into what you will be saying at the conference that's coming up in terms of maybe a word or two about how spirituality does enrich the traditional ways and studies and practices of looking at, for example, teams.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. The spiritual traditions have a lot to say about teams. First, they have a lot to say about the dignity of each person as a member of a team. They have a lot to say about the value of community. They have a great deal to say about individual charism and the way in which communities call forth individual gifts. And they have a way of allowing people to be present with a sense of mutual appreciation as opposed to hyper-competition. They have a way of helping teams focus on being contributory rather than being competitive. They have a way of driving the motivations of a team towards greater nobility of purpose and mission. And so a leader imbued in that kind of an understanding of team, instead of arriving at Conference Room 109 simply having a task agenda, arise with an ethos and has an understanding of the team as community and the team as a pot of energy that can really serve humankind in a different way. And so I will develop those kinds of themes and suggest that a team seen through the lens of that kind of a context is a different human experience than a team where people just come together to accomplish a task, are focused on a narrow aspect of their task, often slip into anxiety about whether or not they're appreciated, et cetera.
That's wonderfully stated. If this is an infomercial for coming to that conference, I might be persuaded.
Bill Weiss, if you don't come to that conference, you should be ashamed.
These are very, very helpful words and a great statement. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Joe. I'd love to see you at the conference, Joe. That would be wonderful.
I think I'm going to be in Spain, Judy. Otherwise, I would definitely be there. I hope that you're going to somehow put that into an article or a book or something that we can buy or rent or whatever, because it sounds like it's going to be wonderful.
Well, we are videotaping all the keynote talks, and we'll put them for free on the website. So it's not the same as being with us, but you will have access to that.
What is the date of the conference exactly?
October 31st and November 1st.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And have a safe trip to Spain.
Thank you. And I will try to go to that.
Great.
Ken DeRush in Prince Edward Island.
Hi, Ken.
At our university, Andre, we have a new president who's been here for about a year and a half now, and we're embarked on a future directions planning exercise. It's less than satisfactory, shall we say. Question is, have you any experience with university communities that for themselves have tried to approach an examination of their organizations in this way?
The answer is
it's
yes.
It's a lot more complicated, it seems to me, in a university than it is in a company.
You know, I'm not sure that's true.
Well, good. Convince me otherwise.
It depends on the nature of the industry, but knowledge-based, science-based organizations have as many highly educated people, have as great a need for individual autonomy, and similar great egos. And so if you think of healthcare or you think of a software firm, I think the challenges are not so dissimilar as they once were.
Yeah.
I'm not... I'm not able quickly to answer your question because it's what's involved in such an effort is very, very complex. I'll just make three comments. The first is I agree with Henry Mintzberg in the sense that strategic planning, as we used to know it, is no longer viable. I had a president of my university who was one of the great figures in comprehensive higher education, Paul Locatelli, and he was really a brilliant man, a great president. But could he know what innovation was necessary in microbiology? Could he know what innovation was necessary in organization theory? Could he know what innovation was necessary in modern dance? The point being that the most successful large-scale organizational strategies rely on a movement towards decentralized leadership, distributed leadership, and a lot of bottoms-up change.
Yep.
And universities that try to shortcut that by declaring from on high beyond anchoring values, beyond common responses to an environment, beyond mission and values, often disempower rather than actually empower the faculty members and the rest of the organization. Because while the things that they normally arrive at are in themselves important, they're such a small piece of what a university has to do to be strategically successful in the present tense that if as much energy were spent on creating cultures that enhance bottoms-up innovation, that really call on the gifts of all participants in the organization, that create rhythms and sequences of continuous innovation, we'd be better off.
Yeah. Thank you. That is helpful.
But there is, there are some overarching values that a strategic plan can be very helpful with. It can differentiate the institution. It can place the institution in a particular market with a particular set of values. The question is, in what ways is your institution different from another institution? And that's important. And it can, in its mission and values statement, emphasize certain segments of society that it will serve with particular energy. So their directional vision is very important, but the achievement of that directional vision largely depends on subsidiarity and the development of energy and throughout the organization, and that's more a matter of creating a culture that's supportive of bottoms-up innovation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your question, Ken.
Hi, this is Lynn Bourget, Dr. Lynn from Scottsdale. Hi, Judy. How are you?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
It's great to hear your voice. Andre, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. I'm sitting here reveling in hearing what you're saying because when I started Positive Appreciative Change Leadership back in the 70s on an intuition from spirit. I was raised as a mystic. I had no companionship whatsoever and certainly no support from academia like you're doing. So it's so refreshing and affirming and supportive to hear what you're doing, and lovely, the integrative way that you're pulling all the disciplines and points of view together is to me, the only approach to survival in the world, actually, as well as transformational. I have a question, and that is, how in your work on spiritual formation are you applying that to organizational culture, which is one of my passions, transforming culture?
Culture is, culture has to be at the heart of a successful organization.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Twain said it's easier to move a cemetery than to change culture.
I love it.
To me, the critical, there are two critical dimensions of culture that, there are many, but the two pivotal starting points for culture. And the first question is, to whom are you in service to? And what are the needs of the people that you're in service to?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can develop a culture that really constantly attends the way in which it serves nobly, compassionately, with high energy and with great commitment, so that the culture is not built on the aggrandizement turning the arrows inward, but it's always directed outward, that's one big step.
Mm-hmm.
And as organizations mature, they tend to be in service of themselves and forget that they were formed to be in service of the patient, the client, the user, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, can they become an oasis of goodness where what happens inside the organization, rather than diminishing, injuring, debilitating individuals, really creates a place of great trust and mutual support, so that there's no wasted energy, so that in service of those that one serves, people are really freed, find freedom because of the supporting characteristic of the culture to generously be in service of others.
So you're saying that in order to serve others at the highest level, you need to be operating yourselves at the highest level.
That's the story.
Mm-hmm. I find that having done this work as a practitioner for over 30 years, that when clients embrace this idea of owning their strengths and their greatness, and that's done through an appreciative process, I did my dissertation on that, then the whole aggrandizement, power over ego thing, it kind of melts away, because they all see that they weren't owning or using even a fraction of their abilities. And they see what they can step into. And it becomes very mutual, you know, wanting to bring out the best in each other. And I find that that's very liberating for them. They become much more willing to change and look at themselves and do transformational work, but there's no conflict in it. There's no upsets. And so the idea of being of service, then, it's almost a natural flow. I mean, I don't mean to imply that I'm not very careful in my interventions and my process. I'm very careful with that, very honoring. But it seems to flow naturally that once they have the idea of focusing on each other's and their own greatness, that then they long to serve. They want to do better. They want to be more effective with the people that they're serving, all of the stakeholders. And that's not something that I started out intending them to see. But it's something that I've learned from the clients over time.
I think that's true. The only thing that I would add is that it's done with imperfect people.
Mm-hmm.
And that people will slip into error and imperfection. And so that part of spiritual maturity is to accept human weakness, not endorse it, not support it, but not to, that we have to live in a world of imperfectibility. And so part of our ability to be successful is to have a great sense of forgiveness of self and the others around us as we aspire to behave the way that you so well described.
Mm-hmm. I love your distinction between the distinction between accepting versus endorsing a human limitation.
What, you know, the danger that I've found in organizational intervention is that people get very excited.
Hey, Ray, how are you?
Begin to taste that, those possibilities that you spoke of so in such a lovely way. But then as they continue their efforts, they encounter human frailty.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins to derail them. And so I think it's important from the get-go to say that we'll have to struggle through this with human frailty.
Mm-hmm.
And that we will never, it's never going to be a utopian organization, and the outcomes will never be a utopian outcome.
Mm-hmm.
That it's
I always tell them, as long as we're down here and we don't down here on the physical plane, we don't have our wings yet, we're going to have things we stumble over.
Well, there it is. That says it perfectly.
Well,
thank you so much
for what,
Lynn,
you're doing. I really appreciate it. Lovely work. Absolutely lovely work.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
My pleasure, dear.
Someone else have a question or a comment? And if you're trying to speak and you don't get a response, I may have had you muted because of background noise. And you can always try to do *6 to unmute yourself. But I think everybody's unmuted now.
Ken DeRosh and PEI, I have another question, but I don't want to use it if someone else has one.
All right, well, why don't we wait about 20 seconds and see if someone else jumps in, and if not, Ken, you go for it.
Okay.
We can use 20 minutes of beautiful silence if no one jumps in.
Judy?
Go ahead, yes.
Judy, Jan Fareed.
Hi, Jan. How are
Hi.
You?
Hi. Well, good. I just wanted to say thank you. This is wonderful. And I just wanted to have a comment. I don't really have a question, but I wanted to say that it's because of Elmer Burak that I met both you and Andre, and I'm assuming you know that Elmer died in August.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Oh.
Yeah, he died in August, and I didn't go to the service, but I drove in so that I could meet his wife, Ruth, face-to-face, and he had been slipping the last 2 years, and really, it was some kind of cancer, I really don't know what kind, but he got really, really thin, and the last time I talked to him was in April, I think. But I just want to let you know that because I know both of you because of Elmer, and so I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing it. Lynn spoke about the fact that how fortunate we are not to be lonely because there's so many more people addressing these topics. But even in the days when these topics were not addressed openly, quietly among some individuals, there were very deep spiritual conversations. Homer was one of my closest companions and role models. It was actually Elmer who put me in touch with Zalman Schachter Shalom, who had a great influence in the development of my teaching. I will always be, he has always remained friend and counselor and mentor, and thank you for sharing the news of his passing. I will hold him in heart and prayer this evening.
Thanks, Jan. We have time for one last question. So, Ken, why don't we come back to you?
Okay. My question has to do with, I am also of Roman Catholic background, and I'm interested in the work that David Miller is doing in connection with Caritas in Veritate, the papal encyclical, and applying that to the world of work. And I've had some conversation with David about coming to PEI to talk about that. So have you any knowledge of or comment on that work, Andre?
Papal encyclicals, there are some that are more attractive and some that are less attractive. It was certainly one of the most attractive encyclicals.
Okay.
It was, to me, filled with a great deal that was positive and beautifully expressed. And so I thought it was a lovely document. There was a recent document that Michael Naughton helped co-author on from the Vatican on the topic of business leadership.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've seen that or not, but I think that is a splendid piece of work.
Okay. It's called Michael Naughton,
Naughton.
Okay.
He's at St. Thomas University.
Yes, I think I'm sure I have that. I got because the one I have came from St. Thomas University, so
okay.
Pretty sure I have that, and it is a beautiful piece of work.
In terms of a document that is immediately and directly applicable to the challenges associated with business and economics, that document I think is a treasure.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. I'm going to wrap things up now by sharing one announcement. And, Andre, if you have any announcements, you're welcome to share those too. I will close with a reading and then let you do the final words, Andre, if that's okay with you.
All right.
So my only announcement besides the Wisdom at Work conference at the end of the month, and I do want to encourage people, if you haven't signed up and you're planning on coming, please sign up. We're looking forward to having you there, and it's a wonderful opportunity to continue this dialogue with a lot of like-minded people who come from different walks of life. Our next teleconference is October 19th with a dear friend of mine and Andre's, Robert Ouimet, Dr. J. Robert Ouimet, who is chairman of the board of OCB Holding Company in Montreal, who has been running his company based on Catholic social thought principles for about 40 years. He will be a keynote speaker at the conference as well, and he'll be talking about the different kinds of management principles and activities that they have in his company that balance spiritual well-being and economic well-being. So that's at 8:30 a.m. Central. All the details are on our website, and I will be sending that out in a newsletter as well. So I hope you'll join us, and you'll let other people know about that. Andre, do you have any announcements?
I don't have any announcements, but Judy, I want to express my appreciation for the work that you're doing. You have been an incredible source of hope and courage and someone who has brought so many of us together in creative ways. We're a far better society, and we're a far better set of universities because of your leadership, and I just want to express my appreciation for that. And you know, this telephone call is just one small piece and hundreds of different things that you are enabling that bring people together in creative ways. So my gratitude to you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my great joy. I couldn't I just can't imagine doing anything else. So Thank you so much.
I'd like to reflect that too, Joe. Judy, you really, I read your newsletter, your online newsletter religiously, and have passed it on to dozens of people. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's great that you're getting the word out to others. It's all about community for me. The more that we can come together and share ideas and experiences and questions and struggles and hopes and models, it's like that's how we shift things and make the world a better place. Mm. Well, no one of us could do it alone, but together I think we can make a huge difference.
Mm. Thank you. So,
I'd like to share a closing reflection that, again, is something that came from Andre's paper, but he is quoting Thich Nhat Hanh, and this is how you ended your paper, so I thought this would be a wonderful way to end today's teleconference before you have your last words, Andre. Thich Nhat Hanh says, "The best way to take care of the future is to take care of the present moment. Practicing conscious breathing, aware of each thought and each act, we are reborn, fully alive in the present moment. We needn't abandon our hope entirely, but unless we channel our energies toward being more aware of what's going on in the present moment, we might not discover the peace and happiness that are available right now. The well is within us. If we dig deeply in the present moment, the water will spring forth." Andre, thank you so much for being on the call and for accepting my invitation to come to the conference and for all that you have been and all that you are in the world. It's just a real pleasure and an honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much, and deep gratitude to all friends and new acquaintances who have joined this telephone call. It was a privilege to be with you.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.